Hello everyone, welcome to the Paul Garcia Show. I'm your host, Paul Garcia. Today I'm speaking to two young Republicans from Illinois State University, Eduardo Monk, who is running for the 6th District on the McLean County Board. Did I word that right? I worded it wrong.
You got it pretty close. You got it pretty close enough.
Okay, what is it?
It's the McLean County Board in District 6.
There we go. Okay, and we have, you know him already, he's been on the show, Kev Ferris, host of Speechless on Cities 92.9. Kev, thanks for coming.
Oh, of course. Thank you for inviting me, Paul. I'm always happy to be here, especially with my good buddy, Eddie.
Oh, yeah. They're reuniting.
Oh, yeah, in his journey. In his election journey, he did say. I mean, I don't know if he'd like me splaying him like this already, but he said this morning that he was getting burnt out of the campaign. He's ready.
Hey, goodbye votes. We don't count memes.
No, I'm kidding. It's just, but that's the thing. And I'm sure you ask any candidate. I know it's election season. I know you probably have a bit of a schedule to get on for what we're talking about today. But that's the thing, is you ask any candidate, and going through a campaign at any time, there's points when you feel like there's a burnout, especially right before the election. You've been working so hard, you've been out knocking doors like anything else. Eddie will tell you about the things he's done, and they get so burnt out, and I don't blame them. I mean, they're up early in the morning every day. They have so many, they have different rallies they're going to, they have like I said, doors they're knocking on, they have people to manage, funds to try to acquire from people to ensure that they can fund the campaign, the government to work on when they have the FEC knocking down their door, making sure that they're doing everything by the book, forms to fill out. There's so much that goes into it when it comes to running for office on either side, Democrat, Republican. And I have so much respect for those that do decide to run for office because of the amount of work that it takes. And so when I say Eddie might be feeling a little tired, it's because that's what a campaign does to anybody. Mm-hmm. Some people are just good at hiding it, and some people are honest about it, like Eddie is.
Right. Is that true, Eddie? Are you getting tired?
You know what? It is definitely a little exhausting at times, but there's always stuff that keeps me going. There's always fun. I remember there's this Booker T. Washington quote out of his book, Born a Slave, and he's something that has always stuck with me for so long is, it's amazing how much encouragement you can find when you work your hardest. That when you just keep pushing and you keep working and keep striving, you'll find just little pieces of encouragement along the way. And I find it all the time. You know, every time I'm talking to a door with a voter and they end up, you know, I just kind of talk, I'm just, you know, I have a conversation with them and I walk away, you know, they shake my hand, you got my vote. It's just little things like that where it just really reminds me of why I'm doing this and what I'm doing it all for.
How many doors do you think you've knocked on?
Oh, man. So for my campaign, I couldn't even tell you. It's been hundreds. And keep in mind that I've been hitting doors since January. Like, this campaign season, man, has been going for months now. So at this point, it's well into the thousands of how many doors we've gotten through so far.
Mm-hmm. And when you say we, who is we? Is it just you by yourself?
Luckily, I got a few volunteers that come out to help me out during the weekends. Mm-hmm. Yeah, luckily, since I'm president of College Republicans as well, we have a really, really solid little group there who really are helpful, really want to get active, really want to get engaged. And luckily, my district is very, very close. Like, ISU's campus is within my district. So even like freshmen who don't have cars, it's like, hey, just come out and hit the neighborhoods around campus. And it works out really well like that.
Okay. Now, first of all, how many people are running for this spot? Is it two? I don't know how it works. How many people are running for the spot that you're going for?
The way the county board is broken down, and I'll just kind of give this the big picture of just how everything works for the county board. So the county is broken up into 10 districts. They are all separated by population. So there's about 17,000 people per district. And there are two representatives per district. So my district is District 6, which by area is the smallest district. But that is because it just has such a dense population. It's, you know, you got ISU's campus, Uptown Normal there. And so you have all the student living, all those apartment buildings surrounding campus. So it is a very, very dense student population there. And within the race right now, there are three running. It's me, and then you got two other Democrats who are running. And so it's just two out of the top three are going to get it by the end.
Two out of the top three. And yes. Is it two Republicans, you and one other student, and then some Democrat?
I'm the only Republican running.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep. Which is very, very strategic, because what we're trying to take advantage of is the undervote piece of all this.
Okay. And I'm looking on my phone right now because I was reading an article this morning. I was trying to read up on everything. It's kind of it's difficult for me. Oh, look. Now the pantograph won't let me look at the article. Okay. So here's what it says here. I thought this was interesting because the Pantograph is a left-leaning newspaper.
Did you actually know, Paul, real quick, that the Pantograph was originally a Republican newspaper?
Really?
When it was founded, I think it was called like the Republican Pantograph or something. But like the founding of the Republican Party actually was pretty much in McLean County. Not officially. Officially, it was somewhere up in Wisconsin. Like the official like date the Republican Party was founded. But Lincoln worked in the McLean County Courthouse, the historic one, back back in the day before he before he was president. And he was the first Republican ever elected as a president. There's a lot of other people that were foundational to the Republican Party. And originally, the Pantograph was a source for the forming Republican Party to get their information out there.
Did you say Abraham Lincoln worked in the McLean County Courthouse?
Yeah, he did.
I am an idiot. I didn't know that.
Yep.
That's incredible.
You're not alone in this. This is something that always amazes me. There's so much history here.
About the Republican Party specifically.
Yeah, there's that statue of Abe Lincoln right outside the old courthouse, so I guess that makes sense.
I know. I just feel like it's such a blowed opportunity. It's like, well, I just wish we'd build the history into our into what we are now, because it's just so incredible how much we have here.
This is what I read this morning. It says, so this is the Pantograph, District 6. In the 6th District, which includes Illinois State University, two students are vying for the spot on the board alongside incumbent Democratic board member Beverly Bell. Although housing is an issue, Bell said that there is a need to protect the county's farmland and in the future and not necessarily engage in urban sprawl. However, she added that there should be more mixed-use development on the outskirts of subdivisions. By having small or medium-sized apartments near the county's single-family housing, it could give lower-income residents the incentive to own their own house down the road. McLean County could also do a better job of maintaining its nearly 2,000 miles of roads, especially heading into the Rivian automotive plant, Bell said. I would like to see us do more construction and repairs in the evening hours, she said. ISU students Eduardo Monk, who is running as a Republican, and Jack Henry Abraham, who is running as a Democrat, both could not be reached for comment. Anyone reach out to you?
That's odd, because I've not gotten a thing from them.
Hey, that's how you
this
know
is
what
my
I
first time hearing about this article, too.
Are you serious?
I had no clue.
That's funny. No, what? Man, it's from the Pantograph. They have your picture in there and everything.
That's cute.
Is this like a whole full like, county-wide race?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it has all the people, something about all the people running for for the McLean County Board, I guess, all the districts. So you never heard about that till just now?
Nope, I have not gotten a single email, Facebook message, nothing from them.
All right, well, interesting. Okay, so
That's a big story right there, Paul. Like, yeah. They're saying that he has no comment.
Yeah, it's like, dude, we just couldn't get it out of him. He wouldn't talk. He wouldn't talk. He's a phony. That's interesting. Okay, no. So did you know, though, that there is that other student running? That's what I meant.
Well, yeah, well aware there's another student running. I haven't had much interaction with him in the past. He's kind of a, I wouldn't say a quiet guy, but he's definitely kind of in on just kind of on the Dem side, just in his own little lane.
Hmm. Like, what's his name?
Jack Abraham.
Jack Abraham.
So for me, you know, I'm rather involved in campus politics, president of college Republicans. I'm in student government. He isn't involved in any of that. So I'm, you know, I respect him running. It's great to see another student in there, but I'm also like, how did this opportunity come to him? And I'd love to be able to ask him that, because I'm just kind of curious more than anything.
Or what motivated him? I think that's kind of might be more what you mean a little bit too. Is what motivated him? Because we really, because the thing is like I've been ever since I was a freshman at ISU, I've made a name for myself being known to talk politics with people and be involved, and I had never really heard of him either, and so it was kind of interesting to me to hear that he was running. I was wondering, maybe his level of involvement was a lot different than I knew.
What I would assume is he's more involved with the county Dems.
Probably.
Okay. I do want to tell the people, and you guys, of course, I reached out to the ISU Democrats, and I got a message back. I was like, hey, I have Eduardo Monk coming on. I'd love to have someone come on with a countering viewpoint on everything, just a Democrat, a young Democrat, and we'll have a good conversation. They're like, let us, you know, see who's interested or something like that. And a couple days went by, I reached out again, hey, you got anyone? No response. It's hard to get Democrats to come on this show. Maybe they're scared because I've had David Paul Blumenschein on, but they should be reassured because I've had Eric Rankin on, who's a professor at ISU, very staunch Democrat, and then Patrick Cortese as well. I've had these two trans activists, which were interesting episodes. I've had a trans initiative, I don't know what to call him. He's a doctor that's pro trans surgeries and everything like that. So I don't know why they won't come on, but I've had so much trouble with it.
We had the conversation, Paul, where it was me and Eric, and we had a great conversation just going back and forth, and it never got really hostile or anything. Yeah, we found places we disagreed. We also found places where we agreed. And so I really don't understand why there's any kind of hesitancy, because you've been more than respectful to both sides for this show, and I greatly appreciate it.
And so. I think the thing with Eric Rankin is he can really defend his points very well. He's very smart to the point where he's funny. If someone is so smart and they understand their points so well that they can make jokes about it to get their points across, they understand the topic well. So I really like him. Eric Rankin, I'd love to have you back on. I've reached out to him. He's a hard guy to get a hold of. He says, yeah, man, I'm down for it. All right, what about Thursday? No response. Friday, Saturday. So, yeah, I just want people to know I'm trying to get these Democrats on. I'm trying to get people from the left on. It's just they're hard. And I guess that kind of doesn't help the stereotype. People think that people from the left tend to not be as structured and like on time and businessy as people on the right. Maybe I'm making that stereotype up. I don't know. But
I know what you're saying. And I don't even necessarily think it's that. I think that the worry is that they'll actually might actually be challenged. And I know this sounds a little conceited because I think it comes up a lot. I mean, like, I've tried to invite Democrats on my show before too, on Speechless, and it's not easy. And like, yeah, I get it. Cities is a conservative station, but anybody who knows me knows that I'm down for it. As long as the discussion remains respectful the entire time, I have no problem with it, and I'll be just as respectful right back. The problem that I see is that a lot of times, and even when I've had off-air discussions with Democrats, just at going to the Starbucks and the Bone Student Center or anything, there's been times where I'll say something that doesn't match their rhetoric as much and doesn't agree with their point of view, and they get visibly flustered.
If you've been living with an aching back, debilitating imbalances, or any physical discomfort and just want to get back to living a fit and happy life, look no further than In Motion Fitness Center and Outpatient Therapy at Fairview Haven in Fairbury, Illinois. Our highly skilled therapy team will guide you through proven and effective exercises to help you regain your strength, movement, and mobility, all with our renowned level of love and care. Live your best life. Call our therapy team at 815-692-6724. To find out how we can serve you today.
Like, they couldn't believe that somebody holds that opinion. And I'm not saying this is every Democrat. Like I said, we had a great conversation with Eric Rankin. But there are many where when you try to start poking holes into their arguments, they either shut down, they get offended, anything like that. And not to say people on the right don't do that too. But the thing is that we – a lot of people on the right, especially the people that you've had on – can come on and have a honest discussion, and when poked holes at their argument, they'll either try to find a way to fill it, or they'll admit their wrongdoing. I mean, there's been times when you've gone a little bit at DPB about some of the things that he believes, and he finds, and it's about discussion and fine-tuning really what you believe. And that's what the discussion is truly about. When you have a discussion with somebody who disagrees with you, is you're able to fine-tune exactly what you believe and maybe even have your mind changed or morphed a little bit to really have a sound like line of logic in the way you're thinking. And that's really what it's about. I always think about, to conclude this diatribe, I always think about Barry Goldwater has a quote, and I have it it's like the subject line of my school email, and it's, to disagree, one doesn't have to be disagreeable. And that's pretty much what I try to live my life by. Yeah, when I'm on my radio show, if it's just me talking, I can get a little emotional. I can get a little angry because that's the way I feel about certain things. But if I'm having an open, honest discussion and somebody's willing to sit down with me, I can control myself, you know, because I want to make sure that we can actually get to the heart of those issues and understand why each person thinks the way they do.
Yeah, and I think what you're alluding to a little bit here, and I'll go as far as to say the right at large, the people on the right, the conservatives, are so used to being shut down that they are less aggressive and defensive when someone tries to shut them down, when someone disagrees with them. It comes with the territory of being a conservative. More often than not, you go out in public and you say a thing like, man, you know what? I like Trump. 10 people come after you. I'm just drawing a weird picture here, but 10 people come after you versus if you say, you know what? I voted for Biden. I'm pro women's rights. I am pro abortion is human right. No one's going to get mad at you, because conservatives don't get mad and try to shut down as often as people on the left try to shut down people on the right. I really think that, and that's a broad, bold statement, but I think that's the case.
I think that in the general public of Illinois, I'll tell you that, in the general public of Illinois, like I haven't gone to visit him yet, but my dad lives in Georgia, in Savannah, Georgia. I'll be going to visit him for Thanksgiving, really excited. But he tells me about like kind of the community down there. It's much more conservative down there. I guarantee you if you had somebody that was more pro-Biden and making a statement like that, they might have a few more people come after them. And so I really do think it's kind of a regional thing, and based on and what's socially acceptable in the community of what you live in, or what's been deemed socially acceptable.
That's probably right. So it's the majority typically shuts down the minority.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. I mean, we've seen that. It's more tangible, but in history, if you look at it, like that's what happened when white people had a dominant power over minorities before the Civil Rights Act and everything and then eventually people started realizing, hey, that's wrong. And so thank God we passed things like the Civil Rights Act, the multiple Civil Rights Acts, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, everything like that. That's more tangible because it's seeable. You can see the difference in somebody's skin color. Mm-hmm. When it comes to political ideology, the thing I've been fighting for on ISU's campus since I was a freshman is the idea of ideological tolerance. And I say tolerance so – I want tolerance. I don't need acceptance. That's you hear the left always say, well, we need LGBTQ acceptance. We need all these other acceptances. Everybody needs to accept these things. No, you don't need to accept something that you don't personally believe in. Same with like abortion. You don't need to accept abortion. To an extent, in the current society we live in, you need to tolerate these things. You can have a problem with it, but you shouldn't act irrationally towards somebody who has a different way of thinking on it. And that's where I fall into it. We need to have a tolerance. We need to have a high tolerance in society for those that disagree with us.
Mm-hmm. And it's easier to have a high tolerance when you're more willing to have deep conversations and meaningful conversations. But if you're not willing to have the conversation, then, I mean, that's the first line of fixing the problem and alleviating the problem and alleviating the tension is conversation. If you don't have that, you jump that step and go to step two, which is outrage. And all right, if you're not going to talk to me, if we're not going to have this conversation, I'm just going to blab my thoughts, unadulterated, unfiltered thoughts out to the world and elicit who knows what, anger, violence, outrage of all sorts. So, Eduardo, I don't know if you wanted to say something.
No, well, I was going to just add on to that because it's one of the most disappointing parts about our modern politics is that I'm somebody who loves to it's sad to me that it's like we can't talk about politics casually the way we do something like sports or movies. Because I'm the type of guy, I just want to have the conversation. I don't take things personal. I don't go after people personally. I just like talking. And I love hearing new perspectives. I love learning new ideas, new thoughts. And to me, the only way you really learn is by the conversation, by discussing, by hearing as many viewpoints as you can, and then coming to your own conclusions based on your own analysis of that.
I completely agree. I could not agree more. And you talked about, first of all, when you're an ideologue, you subscribe to the philosophy of a given way of thinking, conservatism, liberalism, anything, at the expense to your rational thinking and your critical thinking skills. Mm-hmm. And I hate that. That's really sad. When you know exactly how someone's going to respond to a given thing that you say because that is the line of the party or the line of the philosophy, you know exactly how they're going to respond. It's like, man, you're not even freely thinking. You're not thinking this through. You're just giving some bumper sticker slogan in response to what I'm saying. And that's tough. So much good could come about in this world, in this country especially, if we just have more conversations without getting freaked out and frazzled and angry and defensive.
And just people understanding their own viewpoints more. You know, I'm the type of guy, when I have a conversation with somebody who disagrees with me, I want to know what they believe. I want to know exactly why they believe it. I want to know where they're coming from. What is the root? How did you come to that conclusion? But there's a lot of people out there who, like you're saying, who are just, they're following talking points. They got off some, you know, politician speech, and they're just regurgitating all that. And they don't know why it comes from. They don't know where those ideas come from. They just know they believe it because it sounds nice.
What's the last thing that you changed your mind on because of what someone said to you?
Oh, that's a good question.
That's both a great of you.
Question. Jeez.
Yeah.
Man. Yeah, you're really putting us on the spot now.
Eddie comes up with one first.
You know what? I'll tell you something. So. Yeah. With me, I'm not a socialist, of course, but I remember I used to think that no, taxes are inherently evil. It's theft, it's stealing. Until people kind of explained it to me calmly more, I am pro some taxes. And the weird thing about taxes is it's on a spectrum, and the higher you go, the more it seems like socialism. Mm-hmm. In Denmark, people always say that's a socialist country. It's not. It's just more progressive taxation than America. Mm-hmm. It's very capitalist. That's why they're doing well. But I think taxes are a good thing. I think they're necessary. I think it's a percentage of what you make, as long as that percentage, how it's determined, is fair and spread evenly across the population. Mm-hmm. And agreed upon by the population. It's not some governing body saying you pay this and you make them pay it. It's like, if it's agreed upon by the population at large, if a small portion of your income goes towards the well-being in the construction, the roads, all the different things that taxes go towards in that country or that county in which you live, I think it's a good thing. And I had my mind changed on that front, because I used to think taxes were evil, mm-hmm. inherently evil and wrong. But I think it's a good thing.
Actually, kind of got one. This one's not as that seismic. It's a little bit smaller, but something, you know, obviously I really like to think about as a college kid is just college admission, college affordability, student debt crisis, all that. And it's a big, big issue, and it's massive, and there's so many overlaying factors with it. But so the small aspect of this that I really like kind of came around to was specifically admission rates. Because what it is so – admission rates at elite universities are lower than they've ever been. Like, I want to say, like, UC Berkeley in the 1970s had, like, an 85% acceptance rates. Nowadays, it's, like, 5%. And to me, you know, these are elite universities that if people can get into, even if they're coming from lower-income families, even if they're coming from, you know, lower classes, if they're able to get to elite universities, that is their way up. That is their way out. So something that I was really considering is thinking, okay, increase acceptance rates at some of these elite universities, but at the same time also force them to start working in more two-year programs. Because on one hand, I understand that, all right, not everybody is prepared for a four-year institution. Not everybody is prepared to go through a four-year degree of classes. So these elite universities, you add in, you know, two-year trade school programs into these universities, you raise the acceptance rates a lot, and that'll also help the tuition pool raise, bring in more tuition money. So they'll be able to bring prices down over as time goes on. And it also just brings more people out of these lower classes and able to give these people a way out and give them a chance to really just make their way in the world through these universities.
What do you think what's it called when you let in people in a college? I mean, there's this big Harvard court case right now where Asians feel discriminated against. What's that called?
Affirmative action.
Yeah. What do you think about that?
It should not be considered race. To me, it's by merit. To me, that's the only thing you should be considering is getting to universities. Your merit, what your potential is as a student. And to me, race is completely irrelevant to that.
So on Kev's show, you're called the Mexican Missile,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Indeed,
that's
yep.
Part of your title. Do you think that when you were being accepted or they were determining whether or not to let you into ISU, they should have looked at race, or should that not have been a factor?
No. I couldn't care less about race. Don't talk to me about race. Don't bring it up ever. I could not. The only reason why race is I still think is because we just keep talking about it. If everyone would just let it not be a thing, we wouldn't care. I don't care about race at all.
Mm-hmm. Hey, I mean, I hear you. What people will say to that, though, is like, if you're colorblind, you know.
You're a white supremacist, Eddie.
Well, there's two. Well, here's the thing: is that what I do factor in is cultural differences. That I find really enjoyable is like learning more about cultures and accepting new cultures and just being a part of new cultures. To me, that's what actually matters about a person, because that is much more important to their identity than what their skin color is.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen the Black Lives Matter: The Greatest Lie Ever Sold documentary?
I've heard about it, haven't seen it yet.
It's pretty fascinating. Yeah. I'm not even done with it, but it's very fascinating. And, you know, it just seems like you're talking about cultural differences. If you go to the inner city with a vast amount of I've always wondered? I can prove it right now. I have 3% African ethnicity within me. At what point am I black? I really don't know. It's like, he's black, he's Mexican. Mm-hmm. I'm more Irish than I'm Mexican, but people are going to call me Mexican. I see what you mean. It seems like race is arbitrary. It really doesn't matter.
Well, we all know Elizabeth Warren was a Native American.
That's exactly, right, yeah. What's that all about?
1/2000th or something like that, Native American. And
Fairbury Furniture in Fairbury, Illinois has added over 7,000 square feet to their showroom, and that means more selection for you. Why wait for your furniture? You can buy anything on the showroom floor and take it home today. So hop in the car and take the short drive to Fairbury Furniture, where customers love their selection. selection, pricing, and their take-it-home-today power. So many Bloomington Normal residents have made Fairbury Furniture their favorite furniture store, just 26 minutes away in downtown Fairbury.
Hurry down to Fairbury Furniture, where the furniture rocks.
She got a significant amount of her credentials as like a Harvard professor, or I believe it was Harvard, some Ivy League. And it was like a lot of it, like literally on her applications, somebody like had dug up her applications and it said that she was Native American.
Yeah. Well, you
and
know,
like, that's what she was running on. Like part of it was that she was a Native American.
What's
like,
interesting, Eddie, you and I, if you, most Mexicans are majority Native American by their DNA. If you got a 23andMe, if you got a 23andMe test, you spin to the vial, you send it in, they'd zip it around a thingy, they'd look at it, they'd analyze it, and they'd say that you, because you're 24% Mexican, Mexican's not an ethnicity. It's all until 1851. It was just Native Americans spanned all across Canada, what's now the United States and Mexico. And then in 1851, they slapped on a border. And now if you're below that, you are Mexican, but you're Native American by DNA. So me and you, presumably, definitely me, I could go get my Native American card. I don't even know what it does.
Oh, really?
But you get a card, it does some stuff, and I think you get some money.
It's like the NRA.
Yeah, well, it's really interesting, though. You and I could both jump on that and get some points in the victim hierarchy.
I have no idea, because my family tree is just kind of all over the place.
Right, as is mine.
Yeah, and that's one thing when it comes to, like, the race and the ethnicity issues. That's whenever, like, you have to fill out forms or anything, and it always, like, for me, it always says, like, Caucasian or white or anything like that. And I'm always like, come on, man, like, I'm very Irish, you know? And, like, if you look at all the European countries, like, Switzerland, people from Switzerland are different from people than Ireland, that are different from people that are from the UK, that are different from people that are in Germany. Like, there's so many different – and that's just, like, Caucasian cultures alone. And then you – I guarantee you, if you go to Africa, you have people from Uganda are different from people from Djibouti, that are different from people from South Africa. Like, there's so many different – that's the thing that kind of makes me kind of sad about the split up of race, is that it really dilutes the culture.
Well, actually, this is a point – actually, that's going to make a great point. I honestly want to kind of hear your thoughts on this, Paul, because it's something that really riles me up. What is your opinion on the Latinx term?
I think it's stupid.
Thank you.
Latinx. Dude, if someone comes to me and says, you're Latinx? Hi, nice to meet you. I'll be like, don't ever. What are you doing?
The way my dad put it to me, and I don't know if I subscribe to this, but I almost do. He was like, I'd rather be called a slur than Latinx.
Yes, honestly, because you're lumping me in with this weird term that's – made up by the extreme liberals. I don't even know what it means. Latinx?
It's taking the gender out of the language, which is stupid.
I about to say the R word.
Spanish is a gendered language. Like, it's Latina or Latino, and like that's how you determine who you're talking to in a lot of situations in the Spanish language. And so they put X in there to remove the gender from it because of the push for a gender spectrum and all that kind of.
So as not to offend anybody who does not conform.
Well, yep. It's actually a funny story with this. I usually don't like to go after my opponents, but this is a moment I just really want to. So Jack posted to his Instagram about Hispanic Heritage Month, and he used the term Latinx in that post. And I'm like, just call me Latino. Please, just call me Latino. Like, even I put Latino, Latin on my post because I'm like, that's just what we want to be called.
You want to be called Latino?
Yes.
I don't want to be called anything, honestly. I don't give a crap, dude. Just Paul Garcia. I mean, we can talk about... Yeah, I mean, we can talk about... that's not my identity because I'm so many ethnicities. Maybe if you're 95%... Anyone who thinks they're 100% anything... is usually wrong.
Oh, yeah.
If you got a DNA test.
Especially in America now.
And especially, I mean, Mexicans. If you're European, a lot of times you're... No, how does this work, actually? Because there's some European countries that just refuse. Like, they're almost racist against each other. Like, the Irish would never dare marry a... I don't know, Britain? I don't know.
I think it depends on what part of Ireland. I believe if you're in Northern Ireland, they're not a big fan of the Brits.
Mm. Okay, yeah, but like most people are mixed up big time. Mm-hmm. What was I going to say here? Yeah, so I'm not big on anyone calling me by my race. I don't want anything to do with – not that I'm not proud of it. Like, I'm glad to be – I think it's cool looking at my – at being Mexican, because a lot what that means is you're Native American, and then you have a little Spaniard maybe, depending on your ancestry. But I think it's fun looking at the traits that I get from being Native American. You have this thick black hair. You don't go bald. You, depending on if you're Spanish or Native American, your facial hair has something to say with that. Like, you grow much better facial hair than I ever would.
Okay. That, man, that bar is kind of low. Not to my venture, man.
No, but
this is about 3 months of no shaving.
Really?
Yes. This is as far as it will go.
Dude, I went like 3 weeks the other day, and it looked disgusting.
You should have seen him. He used to have a long, luscious, like, mm-hmm. flow that he used
to
have.
I went through my long hair phase freshman year of college. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I'm just going to let it go, see what happens. It got to the ponytail length, and I was rocking the pony for a little while, and I'm like, you know what? This is annoying. I don't want to deal with this anymore.
You had that machismo that they always talk about.
But no, like, Native Americans also, they're supposed to be pretty athletic. They have good, strong feet. They don't have very big glutes for some reason. Like, I looked into this. I'm like, this is fascinating because this is all me. Like, 100% this is me. And
well, everybody, you heard it here first. Paul Garcia has a skinny butt.
Yeah, though, dude, that's true. Everyone knows. You've seen pictures of me? I have no butt. I'm working on it. It's causing me back pain, so I got to do these, like, glute raises or whatever they're called. Yeah, yeah. I'm trying. Okay. We're talking about all sorts of things here. You talked about DPB, how I disagree with him a lot of the time on certain things. I'm on the spectrum of being on the right. I'm not nearly as far right as DPB or Cap Peterson. And I don't know exactly where you guys are on the spectrum. We need to actually get a physical spectrum here and put dots on it. But
we did this like a few weeks ago. We took it with our college Republicans. I did mine individually. I don't know if you've done yours individually recently.
Honestly, mine was pretty close to where the club is.
Yeah. So that means I'm a little further right than you. Probably, like, if you look at the spectrum, I am. So the spectrum is listed as, you're either authoritarian is at the very top, libertarian is at the very bottom, and then right to left is like conservative right, liberal left. Mm-hmm. I am like 5 over right, like it's like over 5-0 out of a scale of 10 on both sides, 10 to negative 10. I'm 5 over and at 0. So like I'm right in between authoritarian and libertarian.
Okay. And interesting. I like those types of graphs. Mm-hmm. But here's what I want to ask. You know, I disagree with DPB. I disagree with Kat on a lot of different things. There was a big article on Cities 92.9 recently, wasn't there? What was it? It was the Washington Post.
Oh, the Washington Post did do an article on us. Yes, the Washington Post. You're going to have Kat on to talk about that one because the majority of the article was really about her. I talked to Annie Goen, was the one who wrote it. When the governor's debate was here, Annie, who's the Washington Post writer, she came to town, followed Kat around a lot, talked a little bit to some other hosts. She talked to me for a bit. I wasn't mentioned in the article. I guess I might be either too tame or I don't know. But so she followed Kat around. The majority of the article was about Kat, a little bit about DPB. They try to frame Cities as to what a lot of the wacko leftists try to frame us as, is that we're far right, we're extremists, and we're
insurrectionists
because DPB and some others that had to do that were affiliated with Cities went to the protest, not the riot, the protest on January 6th. And so they always try to frame us as that. The reality of it is, Paul, is that the Washington Post does the same thing for the other side that Cities 92.9 does, except for they're not honest about it. That's really what it is. We at Cities 92.9, I say it on my show all the time, Kat says it on her show, DPB says it on his, is we're opinion shows. We're out there, and we're a news and talk station. We share the news, and then we talk about it. From our perspectives. Mm-hmm. That's what we do. We are not trying to hide the fact that we're opinion. I say on my show, if you're feeling like you're not getting the whole story or anything, go out and do the research yourself, or go listen to Pod Save America. Pod Save America is a liberal podcast that is done by like former Obama White House staffers, I think. Like things like that. If you think that you want to get another perspective, go watch MSNBC, go watch CNN, go find another podcast. There's a lot of small podcasts that progressives even do. So go listen to those other ones if you don't like what I have to say. Mm-hmm. Or not even if you just don't like it, if you want to get another perspective. What the Washington Post does is that they write these articles, they put out media that is overtly partisan. calls us right-wing extremists. By no means am I a right-wing extremist. They say Kat Peterson is QAnon when she jokingly had a post in front of a sign that said Q.
I saw that. That didn't help her, though.
It didn't help. It didn't help, but she was being funny. And
so she is not
she
QAnon.
She is not a QAnon.
What is QAnon?
That's a rabbit hole and a half right there.
That is a rabbit hole and a half.
I've heard some weird things.
The shortest version of it is that it's – so you know like 4chan?
No. Is that the online weird website or something?
Do you know what Reddit is?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So there's like spectrums here. So Reddit is tame. 4chan is semi-untamed. Then you have 8chan,
yeah,
which is like – which is like 8chan is like sometimes borderline illegal, some of the things that go on in 8chan. Like borderline the dark web, like of the things that are talked about on there. And when I say borderline illegal, it's not everything on there is like super illegal or bad or anything. It's just that it's so unfiltered. Like there's no like any – there's pretty much no moderators of anything on there to where people sometimes use it for blatantly illegal things.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it started on maybe 4chan and then moved to 8chan, something like that. There's a guy that – anonymous person that claimed to be QAnon. It was the name that they called themselves Q. And they claim to be very high ranking, either in like the military, maybe FBI or White House staffer or something, and would always post these claims about things that were going on in government. Claims unsupported, like actually borderline conspiracy theory, if not sometimes borderline, sometimes genuine like conspiracy theory. And I hate using that term because it's been commandeered by the left to say everything that the right says, every idea that they have is a conspiracy theory. When I say it, I mean in the actual like sense of the word. Like you might as well be going out and saying the moon landing was faked, like things like that. And those are possibly arguments you could have, but there are people that like subscribe to QAnon as if everything they say is overt truth and anything anybody else says counter to it is false. And Kat made a joke about being QAnon because it's the thing is, well, here's the thing that she actually did is, and again, have Kat on, she can say it a lot better than me, but the Annie Goin saw a picture of Kat at a Trump rally on Facebook. She was going scrolling through everything trying to find something that she could hit her on, and Kat took a picture with a QAnon sign because she thought it was funny and posted it. Like, I think this was even before she had a radio show. And so Annie asked Kat, are you QAnon? Like, is that something? And Kat said, as much as you are BlueAnon, trying to make like a joke, like you're like, I'm as QAnon as you are a person that subscribes to the left's radical conspiracy theories. So that's how Kat responded, and Annie took that as, well, Kat Peterson must be a QAnon adherent. And so then that's what framed her as that. So that's what the Washington Post tried to do, is they tried to frame all of us as these absolute radicals. When the Washington Post is just unhonest about their journalism, they come out there and pretend like they're this bastion of unbiased, pure journalism, when in reality they're the same. I don't believe really much in unbiased journalism. I believe that everything is looked at through a perspective lens, and so everything you're reading is coming through the perspective of somebody else. Mm-hmm. So the way I say it is, if you want unbiased journalism, go watch C-SPAN. Because C-SPAN just airs exactly what goes on in government. They air any public hearing of any kind, and so
no opinion pieces.
Exactly, it's going to be literally what is going on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a great point that you bring up about Washington Post not being honest and cities being open about what they are. They're an opinion news talk radio, and I think that's a factor I only see with right wing shows, that they're actually forthright and honest. Every conservative commentator out there openly is like, yes, I'm a conservative. If you want a liberal point of view, this is not the place. But I never hear that from liberal outlets.
They're usually like, we're just reporting on the facts. This is the truth. And it's it's through the filter of your opinion.
They're always the pillars of truth and justice, and whatever they say is reality. But they never come out and they never admit the bias.
You think anyone on CNN maybe says, like, hey, you know, I am liberal. This is through my lens that I'm saying this. My opinions are more liberal. You don't think there's that?
I've never seen them. I've never heard them.
And I've watched CNN an okay amount. I mean, I have an interest in media, and I've never heard When Andrew Cuomo used to be on there, I never heard him say anything about
Chris Cuomo.
Oh, I'm sorry, Chris. Yeah, I get the Cuomos mixed up. Fredo 1 and Fredo 2. I've never seen him talk about that they're just sharing their opinion. Don Lemon, I've never seen him talk about it. Rachel Maddow from MSNBC. They never claim that it's just their opinion. I think unverified, my opinion, that they genuinely believe that they are reporters.
Mm-hmm.
That they're doing what's right. And I believe I'm doing what's right too, but the thing is I believe what's right is to share my opinion. I think they believe that they're sharing the right way to think.
I feel like conservatives, that's certainly the side of conspiracy theories. I really do believe that. And what's risky about that is conspiracy theories can get worse and worse and worse, and actually it can become – you can conspiracy theory your way into schizophrenia. They're very linked, actually, and that's kind of how you can see schizophrenia taking hold, is you're believing a lot of conspiracy theories. Then you start believing, you know, the government's this, they're doing this and that, and I truly believe there's a lot of corruption in government. Mm-hmm. I do. Mm-hmm. Tulsi Gabbard believes that too, and she was a Democrat. She talks about it all the time. She says the insider trading, it does happen, but it seems normal there. It's just a normal way things go, so it doesn't seem crazy. It's not like, don't talk about
that. I just want to be clear real quick, Paul. You say that you believe that conspiracy theories are more prevalent or are a thing of the right?
I think, yeah.
Yeah, I just want to be clear on that. Maybe that's the way it's been framed, but I also am old enough to remember 2016, in which Hillary Clinton claimed that the election was stolen by the Russians. And then many million dollars later were spent, an investigation was conducted, a several hundred page report comes from Robert Mueller, and it says that never happened. So who is the real conspiracy theorist? I pose a thought to you, Paul. Is it the right that has more conspiracy theories, or is it the left who has taken a hold of a lot of the culture and the way of which we view our media to where they can frame it to seem like the right is of the conspiracy theory?
I mean, that's a good question. I don't know really, but here's what I can say is I talk to a lot of people on the left and on the right just day to day, and it seems like the people on the right, especially the older people, are like, oh, they're trying to destroy this country. They know what they're doing. The people in Congress, you know, they are colluding together. They're trying to, I don't know, take God away. They're like devil worshipers, even, type of people. They want to remove God. They want to do this. I hear that a lot from the conservatives, and I know a ton of conservatives.
Mm-hmm.
More than I hear it from anyone on the left. And I hear the people on the left saying, nah, the people on the right believing these conspiracy theories. So this is just my belief from the people I talk to day to day.
Yeah, and yeah, maybe there are some that seem wacko, like saying like every Democrat's a devil worshiper or anything. Like, okay, yeah, sure, those seem wacko. But look throughout COVID. Throughout COVID, everything that conservatives came out and said was a quote unquote conspiracy theory. Then you wait 6 months to a year, and then it becomes law, and then it becomes scientific fact. You talk about hydroxychloroquine being a treatment for originally that was called like fishbowl cleaner by the left, and saying
metformin being horse dewormer.
Exactly, conspiracy theories. So I think it's really the way I really think of it is, yeah, maybe there are some wackos. There's wackos on the left too that think that Trump I can't even come up with them, because the thing is like when it comes to conservatives, we have a hard belief in God, and so it's easier to say like, oh, they're a devil worshiper or something like that. When it comes to the left, their conspiracy theories are that Republicans are just colluding with all these foreign nations to bring, I don't even understand how, but like to steal the election and things like that. According to Hillary Clinton, Republicans already have, she had a video that came out about 2 weeks ago that says that Republicans already have a plan to steal the 2024 election. Like,
I saw that.
Yeah. And so when it comes to theirs, Republicans, we have some conspiracy theories, because everybody has a conspiracy theory. I mean, everybody, tell me there's never been a time when you're like, okay, like, I don't have much evidence for this, but it just seems fishy, you know?
You know, and I'm still a firm believer in the lab leak theory.
The lab leak theory, yeah, that COVID was leaked from a lab.
I mean, yeah, I believe that. Exactly. Where this video is not.
But remember, but there's still many that claim originally it was taken off YouTube. It was taken off YouTube being deemed misinformation
and
a conspiracy.
There were Chinese journalists who were getting kicked off Twitter for claiming the lab leak theory. Like,
there was
China.
Chinese like scientists that just got they got gonned. They're nowhere to be found.
And this is a point I wanted to bring up when we talk about conspiracy theories, is it really depends on where the line is drawn. Mm-hmm. For you, because, yeah, you know, you can call Q a conspiracy theory. That is definitely a conspiracy theory. But the lab leak theory, even Fauci was, by the end of this, even Fauci was admitting that, yeah, it's possible that the COVID came from a lab. With only 6 months ago, you couldn't even say that on Twitter. Mm-hmm. So the where conspiracy theories lie is so fluid, and it changes just depending on the narrative.
And think about the word, too, or the phrase, conspiracy theory, idea that – I mean, we could look up the exact
people
definitions.
Are conspiring behind the
exactly,
scenes to do
colluding.
A secret thing.
They're colluding. Yep. People are colluding. Theory, a thought. An idea
this
that
might be
this
the case.
Might be the case. So at the root definition of those two words, it seems like kind of rational. Like it's just like, hey, here's an idea I have. Might be wrong, might be right.
Yeah, but
the problem is when you have people that are conspiracy adherents. When they will – they're not open to any other type of evidence that could be offered against it. And that's what we said. We've seen it with people on the right with things like QAnon. We've seen it with people on the left. There are still people to this day that believe that Russia stole the 2016 election when it is verifiably false.
Hmm. I bet if we did a poll, though, that'd be interesting to see how many people on the left who are registered Democrats believe that the 2016 election was stolen versus people on the right who believe the 2022 or 2020 election was stolen. I bet, but I don't know. What's it matter? I'm just speculating, but I bet the people on the right believe that to be the case more than the people on the left. I don't know, though. I mean, I'm sure both have plenty of conspiracy theorists on their sides. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's going to be a great red wave?
Oh, and here in 2020, I'm going to let Eduardo talk about the election a little bit more. I have a lot to say about it, but
yeah.
He's got his race, so I want to make sure he gets his time.
Yeah, right. So we're hoping. We need a red wave for this county because the way the county board, I'm not sure how much you've really kept up with this, but it is a current 10-10 split right now. Dead right down the middle, meaning that at the ballots, the county board is up for the election. It is like this election will decide who is in control of the county board. And this could be the first time in McLean County history that Democrats have a majority on the board.
Mm-hmm.
So the stakes are about as high as they possibly could get with this election cycle. So that's really fun for me because in District 6, it is almost always two Democrats that come out of that district. It's rare that even a Republican's even running in that district just because of how blue that district really is. So
this is the area right around ISU.
Yeah, ISU's campus and the surrounding neighborhoods around that. So yeah, very, very blue, almost always two Democrats coming to that. So if I'm able to swipe away one of those seats and pull off an upset win on this, that could be a death blow to Democrats for the county board because this is one of their stalwarts that they have in the county.
It's interesting, too, when you say that, and then we look at the Pantograph, and the Pantograph talks to the Democrats, but they didn't talk to Hannah Blumenschein. They didn't talk to you. Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Well,
oh,
and I
gosh.
Also think, and this is, call it a conspiracy theory if you'd like, but I also think that people are not prepared for this to be a competitive race. I think people are seeing District 6. Oh, it's two Democrats. We don't even know who this Eduardo Monk kid is anyway.
Well, the Farm Bureau endorsed you, didn't they?
I got Farm Bureau's endorsement. And then
which
I also
is a
got
big
the,
deal.
Yeah, I got their endorsement, and I got the McLean County's Sheriff's Department's Fraternal Order of Police as well.
Mm.
Their endorsement. So,
So how do you think you've done campaigning-wise?
You know what? If I'm in full transparency, I'm doing my best.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm a 20-year-old kid, never ran for public office before. I've just realized it's the details that's the hardest part. There are just so many little things that they don't tell you about campaigning. Like, I remember just last week, I was driving back from an event, and I'm like, oh, I have a parade tomorrow. I gotta go get candy for it. So I'm just running around Walmart at 10 o'clock at night trying to find candy to get for a parade. And I'm like, this is the side of campaigning nobody ever sees.
Mm-hmm.
There's just so many little things, but it's the details that if I was able to go back and do this all again, it would be the details that I tighten up. It's just tiny things. It's like my yard signs aren't double-sided. It's just tiny, tiny little things like that where I'm like, oh, if you just like – even if you just had somebody who is dedicated to that. And this is why I realize campaign teams and why they're so massive because on my campaign, I'm my own candidate. I'm my own campaign manager. I'm my own treasurer. I'm my own volunteers. I'm my own field director. I'm it all with my campaign. So – you're keeping up with a lot at once with it, but it's been a lot of fun.
It's like 100% marketing. That's the big deal. It's all marketing.
Kevin, I'm not sure if you remember this, but do you remember we got into an argument our freshman year, and I was trying to convince you that politicians are the same thing as salesmen?
I don't remember that, because the thing is I
must have lost.
Well, I didn't lose. It was that I think that we were arguing two different things. I don't believe that it's as much – I think it's – marketing. I don't think it's just sales. There's two different things. I'm a marketing major, right? So I think politics is marketing. So that includes the merch. The team, the people you surround yourself with, the creating relationships. And so sales is just the idea of getting the voter on your side, and it's usually much more verbal and then a little bit of paperwork. That's sales. Marketing is a whole.
Marketing is complicated. It's multifaceted. Yeah. It's advertising is.
It
a
requires
small part
data
of it.
Research. You look it,
psychological deep, insight. Even.
Exactly. There's so much more to marketing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe. And the thing is that not all politicians are marketers, but all politicians have marketers around them.
Yeah.
Because there's some where I forgot who I was talking with the other day, but my sister works in the Capitol, and she has to do she works for Fox News and does interviews with different people that are representatives in the Capitol. And I think it was Mike Lee out of, I believe, Ohio. I think that's one of the Ohio senators. He is notorious for never talking to the media.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he does. And in a way, he's not a marketer because, like, he doesn't want to get his face out there. He doesn't want – like, there's a lot of people like your Marjorie Taylor Greens, your Lindsey Grahams, your Ted Cruz's. They want to get their face out of there. It's a part of their marketing. But, like, your Mike Lee, he's not marketing himself, but in a way that's kind of marketing himself because –
He's establishing himself. He's building a character of the guy that doesn't have his face on
exactly,
TV much.
Which to his constituents might work well because they don't want somebody who's going to draw a super amount of attention to them or anything like that. So that might be how it is. So, yes, we might have had an argument about politicians being salesmen, but I don't believe that politicians are salesmen. I believe that politics itself revolves around marketing.
I think I have to agree with Kev here because marketing is more multifaceted, whereas sales is one transaction. You know, it's like, hey, vote for me. Here's the paperwork, done, sold. But marketing is more broad. It's more psychological. It's appealing to the masses, figuring out who your target demographic is, and then penetrating them. figuring out how to get
there, Paul.
Yeah. Figuring out how to get their vote, how to tell them what they want. It's so vast. It's more marketing because marketing's huge. Like, people have a hard time describing what marketing is, but it's like finding your market and figuring out how to market to them. Yeah, so it's more than just sales, but you both are on kind of the same side.
Well, and like that's the thing, and Eric Rankin, I don't know if he's ever told this story on. I think he might have on your show, but I think it's the perfect example. So he talks about how, especially prior to COVID, they would send students, they would send like 10 students to the Democratic National Convention and 10 students to the Republican National Convention right before the presidential election when they're nominating who is going to be their presidential candidate. And in 2016, they sent students, and Eric always says, he always asks them, what's the message that the convention said? And he had 10 Democrats come back, and they said, because that was Hillary Clinton got nominated, and they said, I'm with her, or change for women, and like all, they had 10 different messages. And then they had Republicans come back, and they all said, make America great again. That is marketing.
Mm-hmm.
That is marketing. Getting everybody behind one central message.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to do so in a way that it's almost subconscious of being able to get people on your side. And that's kind of where I get kind of nihilistic sometimes on politics is because, like, yeah, Republicans did it now. I mean, Obama had hope and change. Like, that's everybody knew hope and change from Obama. And so it kind of seems like it feels like you're getting games played on you a little bit. But that's you asked a question earlier and I never got to it. And it's what I've had my mind changed on. And it goes right into this is when it comes to marketing and everything is when I was younger in Republicanism and conservatism, I used to be much more of a quote unquote bootlicker for corporations and stuff like that. I still believe that capitalism is the best way to build an economy and to build personal wealth. But when it comes to capitalism, I don't necessarily believe that. Having practical monopolies and everything are the best way to we need to make sure there's competition. Competition is what drives actual capitalism. And so, like, you have good Republicans like Teddy Roosevelt who established antitrust laws to ensure that or to try our best to ensure that we weren't having these monopolies saturate markets to the point of which we there's no possible competition or any way for anybody else to break through into that market. And so when it comes to marketing and everything like that, in the business world, what I've had my mind changed on is that businesses don't have your best interest always in mind, and they're not always working for you. In fact, there's times in which they over collect, and you've probably heard of like the documentaries. I forgot exactly what it's called, but it's on Netflix, like The Social Dilemma, I think is what it was called, and the amount of data that's actually being collected on people. And that's what really kind of changed my mind on some things that corporations do. And I'm in a marketing research class right now and learning about big data and aggregators and the amount of info that a lot of people have on you that you have no idea they do. Mm-hmm. And I'm only scratching the surface. Joe Rogan goes into it super a lot with other people. There's I'm sure you could probably find somebody who is a data analyst that knows it even better than I do. But all I know is that it scares me. I don't like it. I don't like looking into it very much because it scares me. And it's an ignorance is bliss kind of thing. And that's what I've had my mind changed on, is that I don't I'm a lot more skeptical of corporations. And it's multifaceted, too. I'm ardently against parts of Big Pharma after learning how OxyContin came to market. The lies that were told to the FDA, but then also the negligence of the FDA for not looking into things. What was the name of that company? The OxyContin's overall, Purdue Pharma, they were an absolute aggressor a fraudulent company in what they were doing, and got so many people hooked on this deadly drug. Along with that, you have how many drug companies are in bed with the government. I mean, you have Bernie Sanders, who for decades talks about how bad Big Pharma is, and then decides to also vote to give them millions and millions of dollars for a COVID vaccine, and then also try to push for requirements of the COVID vaccine that would profit Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson so much more. And then you even have, when it comes to Big Pharma, you have insulin companies and life-saving drug companies that absolutely abuse people with the prices that they're charging, when in reality, when I talk about monopolistic and lack of competition, that's exactly what a lot of these companies do, is they make it so that their prices are so high and everything. But the reason they have this monopoly is because of our patent system. And so if we were able to work on legislation to reduce the amount of patent, then what we could have is we could have the same competition between Advil and Walmart brand Advil for insulin, where it's a pure competition and you can have multiple companies that are really only competing on price.
Right. Yeah, I agree. It's a weird system in Big Pharma right now. Mm-hmm. It's like... Yeah, I guess it is those patent laws, isn't it? I don't know much about it, but I've always wondered, how can you charge so much and there be no competition? Why can't someone just have a similar recipe here and bring it lower? But I guess it's patent laws.
Well, that really, and Democrats say this, and something I kind of agree with them on when they talk about it, is the fact that, I mean, you have people that, you have these companies who the government says, we need to find a cure to this disease. And so the government actually gives grants and helps push funding to find cures for things, or at least treatments, like insulin. And so the government actually helped fund insulin. And then what they do is as soon as they come up with the drug, they patent it through the United States government. And so what the patent does is it basically says for a certain amount of time, I don't know exactly how long it is for pharmaceuticals, but it's a few decades at least. And they put a patent on it. And then basically it's saying, like, for this amount of time, this is the only company that can produce this drug. And so, of course, it basically is a government-funded mandate or a government-funded monopoly.
Yeah. Interesting. That's weird, man. That's weird. That's some Republican or whoever is just going to – they should probably run on that, because I think
Rand Paul used to talk a lot about it.
Really?
Yeah, and he's more of a libertarian Republican. But, yeah, Rand Paul used to talk a lot about it.
Fascinating stuff. And, Eddie, we got to talk a little bit about your race and your campaign here. Tell me, what do you care about in this district? What do you want to change? What do you want to – cast your vote for? What can people count on you to do if you are elected for the board in the 6th district?
Well, to me, there's been really three main issues that I've been really hammering home. We were talking about how politician, you have to market, and you got to set a brand for yourself. And there's kind of been three main pillars. I stole that from Paul Schimpf, by the way, of the three pillars.
The three pillars, Ben.
First off is student representation. The way I've been pitching that to residents is, you know, diverse representation. But to me, it comes down to student representation. Students, we take up 16% of McLean County's population, and therefore, we deserve to have a voice on our local government. You know, there's so many issues that we as students face that are completely unique to our lives compared to the average resident. You know, mental health, food insecurity, tenants' rights, these are all things that students specifically deal with. And to me, really the way I've been framing my race to me, myself in my mind, is that this is our generation starting to step up and take some responsibility for our society. Eventually, we're going to be the ones leading this nation. It's going to be, let's get in now. Let's start being a part of the decisions. The only way you actually achieve any real institutional change is by being involved in the decisions. So that's what I want to get in with. I want to make sure that our generation has a voice in our society. We start stepping up and taking leadership. Now, there are two main issues that I'm really focused on. Is the first off, obviously, economy. You know, McLean County is a very, very business-friendly county compared to the rest of the state, stifling economic policy. You know, you have businesses fleeing the state, but here in McLean County, we keep growing economically. And it's because, you know, we're able to keep taxes low, keep regulation low, keep treating our businesses right, especially our small businesses. Those are the bedrock of any great economy. And then also public safety. You know, we got to support our law enforcement. We got to make sure they're well-funded, well-supported. We got to keep these unfunded mandates off of them. And we also got to get rid of the Safety Act. You know, I can go on for hours about how dangerous that act is going to be. But, you know, trying to find ways to alleviate that for our officers and for our law enforcement, because it's going to be a challenge once that thing passes in January. So those have been my three main focuses throughout this campaign. I try to keep it real, just focused on those three, because to me, those are the three most important issues that are going to be on everybody's mind.
So the Safety Act is very interesting. Hopefully we can talk a little bit about that.
Mm-hmm.
Your job, your role, your responsibility, if you are elected as a member of the McLean County Board in the 6th District, there's two people per district, is that right?
Yes.
Your job would be to what? Vote on things and about how we use taxpayers' money?
So the county board, so a lot of Democrats misunderstand this. The county board is a very administrative position. We are just making sure everything gets to the right places. So we're dealing with, you know, the sheriff's department, the health department, you know, the county owned nursing homes. We deal with, you know, property taxes. We deal with the roads and the basic infrastructure. We deal with, you know, the public amenities around McLean County, which is, you know, like the public parks, lakes, all that. And, you know, we're also, since McLean County is kind of a it's kind of a weird little mix. You have a really, really large suburban area right here in the center, and then you just have farmland with a bunch of little small towns scattered around. Mm. And those are the small towns that rely very, very heavily on the county for support. So, you know, the town of Normal and the city of Bloomington, they're their own independent entities. The county doesn't really deal with the Normal or Bloomington.
Really?
Mm-hmm. This is something I hear a lot. So people are like, I always, you know, going door to door. The roads is something people always mention. It's like, fix the roads, fix the roads.
The roads are horrible, man.
They are. But the problem is that all the roads through here are owned by the town of Normal, meaning that it's Normal's roads. They're the ones who are funding it.
The city of Normal.
So that'd be a city council issue. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's a city. So the roads, let me get this straight. The roads and how holy and terrible they are in Normal, that is an issue for the city of Normal, the city council of Normal.
Yeah, that's going to be the town council. Yep.
You on the board cannot change this.
Nope. We deal with the county roads. So anything surrounding Bloomington Normal, those county roads, those are what is funded and what is kept up by the county board.
Okay. So the roads going to Towanda and stuff and like Lexington.
Like Veterans? What is Veterans a county road?
Veterans, I think.
Can you give me
state,
a county road? What's a county road?
County, oh man, there's so many just little ones surrounding. If you've ever taken a drive just outside of Bloomington Normal.
You're talking about like the 2800 Northeast roads and
yeah,
things like
those,
that?
Those
yeah.
Long country roads?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, those are the roads that you would be responsible for.
Yes.
Okay. Interesting. Well, anyway, continue then. So your job will be to determine what the taxpayers' money funds.
Yes. Yep.
Okay. And it has to be property of the county, not property of the city of Normal.
Yep. Correct.
Okay. Interesting. And what's the biggest thing you think that the taxpayer money should go towards right now?
Oh, right now it's deservedly is the sheriff's department. It is the law enforcement up in our McLean County. I mean, but especially with a lot of these unfunded mandates coming down from the state, which is only going to get worse throughout once the Safety Act
like
gets passed.
Body cam requirements.
That's going to be the really the big one. I was talking with Matt Lane, the incoming McLean County Sheriff's, about this, and what he was telling me is that the deadlines for the body cameras, it is soon. The body camera deadline is sooner for smaller departments. And the state police has a longer deadline to get the body cameras. So these very small police departments that have very, very little funding, who are already barely, you know, barely keeping officers on the job, now have to go out and buy rather expensive body cameras it's much sooner than the large state police that do have the resources to do something like this.
So why would they do that? Why would they make these small police organizations with less means to get the job done?
Oh, it's a simple misunderstanding. I mean, this is the Safety Act was passed without barely any law enforcement input. I mean, what you're seeing right now is over 50 states' attorneys have already sued the state over the Safety Act. Every single person in law enforcement knows how much of a disaster this is going to be, but legislators don't care. They didn't bring any of them on board for this.
So what does the Safety Act entail for people that don't know?
So the Safety Act, in essence, so mind you, this thing is an absolute cluster. So over 700 pages passed at 4 in the morning. And if you ever have the opportunity to have Dan Calkins on, the state rep from Decatur, he can break it down because he was telling the story of just the way it was passed. And it was just insane the way it went down. But
middle of the night or something like that, right? Wasn't it kind of secretive?
4 a.m. It was a – have you ever heard a gut and replace?
Nope.
So what it is they passed an innocuous bill that was supposed to just be for prison voting information, like for convicted felons after they get out, they get voting information. That passed, and then Democrats brought it back as the Safety Act. So they took everything out and put in just 700 pages of what the Safety Act is now. Passed at 4 a.m. during a lame duck session. So it was literally 20 minutes before the next assembly was going to take over was when it was passed. Mm. So yeah, it was insane the way he was breaking it down. But in essence, what it does is it prevents judges from being able to detain certain criminals. So what it does is it gets rid of cash bail. So what all bail is really just your incentive to show up back at court. But now that's gotten rid of. So now what it is that you.
Explain that a little bit further. So what is cash bail, and what does it mean for it to be gone?
So man, I remember seeing Tom DeVore just last week on this, and he explained it way better than what I'm going to be able to explain it as. But really what it is so somebody commits a crime and somebody is accused of a crime. They're put before a judge and that judge decides whether or not they should be detained or not. And, you know, they go through, you know, everything from, you know, their danger level, you know, are they going to believe that this person's going to return to court? And if the judge deems that the person is safe enough to be just let loose, let free in society, then they can do that and they'll just put cash bail on them, which gets them to come back to court for their court date. Now, if a judge deems that this person is a danger to society, then they are free to detain that person until their court date. Mm-hmm. What the Safety Act is, it gets rid of that entire system, throws it completely all out. So now judges no longer can detain criminals of certain offenses. So things from burglary, arson, aggravated DUI, they are not allowed to detain these criminals. All they're allowed to do is the state's attorney has to file a petition to detain the criminals.
Okay. So it just makes it easier for them to get on out of there. And will they run away more often, do you believe?
Yes. Oh, 100%.
Just like, I'm not coming to court. You let me out. I didn't even have to pay anything. Screw that.
Exactly, yeah.
So that's a concern. You're going to be letting criminals back out on the street, and in all likelihood, they're going to come to their court dates less often.
Mm-hmm. And that's all that's all it's going to do, yeah.
Didn't J.B. Pritzker say he would consider rediscussing this?
sorry if I don't know if you got it on video, but I had to go to the bathroom. I've been guzzling this water over here while we're talking. But when it comes to that, I'm sure Eddie could talk about it too, but he was very choice with his words because it was the debate specifically at the Illinois State University Governor's Debate. J.B. Pritzker was asked whether he would consider changes to the Safety Act, and he was very vague in his answer on purpose. We could relook at a few things.
We could
strengthen it, like things like that. Very political answers, like politician-like answers, where it's vague so that he doesn't actually have to be held accountable to anything. He can just be like, "Well, I said we'd take a look at it."
Okay. Do you think it's gonna pass? And what are we gonna?
So it's currently passed, yeah, isn't it?
It is. It has been passed.
Right. As of right now, it'll be in effect on January 1st. Actually, it will.
Do
be
you
in
think
effect,
it'll change
yes.
before then?
We're hoping.
Or do you think we're gonna do away with cash bail?
No, it's gonna happen, and it's gonna be a disaster for the first few months. And we're hoping that we just realize how bad much of a disaster it really ends up being. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was attempted in even New York City attempted this, and they rolled it back within a few months because of just how. It's just so many ways that it just makes everything harder for law enforcement.
Why do you think Democrats want this?
Well, do you know the origins? DPB talks about it a lot. Do you know the origins of the Safety Act?
Was this what you were talking about, like 4 a.m.?
The lame duck session,
well,
20
yeah,
minutes
but do you know
before.
What it was? Do you know what it was before that?
It was the innocuous bill about a voter felon. Voter information for felons.
Well, how I was informed, maybe it's a little bit different, but how I was informed is that it started off in like 2017. There was an idea for, and it was like a 7-page bill at that point. And it was like, hey, if you're like the breadwinner of your family and you commit a nonviolent crime, then there's opportunities for you to be let out so you could go and work and provide for your family or whoever your dependents are. It was a good faith bill, basically, at that time. It was like, hey, we want to help people that are in a struggling.
So your family doesn't have to suffer for your stupid nonviolent
act. So like if you were shoplifting or something, if you were nonviolently, like not like an armed robbery or anything like that, if you were shoplifting, caught for that, and you were being held for that, then there'd be options for you to be let out so that you could continue providing for your family, and so then nobody else is punished for your bad deed except for you, and then you're still expected to go to your court dates and pay for your crimes in some way.
Right.
But that's what it was originally at, and then as Eduardo explained, likely is that it turned into a 700-plus-page bill that was dropped within like a few hours of them deciding to vote on it, and then it was passed at a special session at four in the morning, so then nobody in Illinois, no media or anything, could pick it up.
How does that – okay, explain this to me because I really don't understand. What's that mean? It was like passed in the middle of the night. When was this bill brought forward? How does it get brought forward? Explain it to me like I'm a third grader. Why is it so freaky? What's the normal way to do things, and why was this so
different?
Oh,
in Illinois, that is the normal way to pass most things.
Because we have a supermajority. Democrats have the supermajority. They can pretty much do whatever the heck they want.
But so a bill, in order to become a law, it has to be – explain this to me. So it gets brought to so it starts at the local level, I thought, and then it gets taken to the state, and they're like, hey, the local level, we think this is a good thing to put into law, to restructure the law. They take it to the Senate.
It starts with a sponsor and a co-sponsor, either in the House. Usually it has to have somebody from the House and the Senate on it in some way.
Okay.
And so
they let the record show I don't know what I'm talking about here, so you please explain.
And I'm only like 90% confident on this too, because I'm comparing it to what I know about how a federal bill. I'm comparing it to what I learned from Schoolhouse Rock. I'm just a bill. No, but that's hot, kind of a joke. I'm a political science major. I know enough. But it starts off with you have a sponsor and a co-sponsor, minimum, like usually like one from the House, one from the Senate, and then it gets brought forth. Usually bills originate in the House. Sometimes they do originate in the Senate, but then they have to be passed through both in some form. When it comes to Illinois, I believe it's pretty much that it's sponsored. It gets brought forth to the Speaker. If it originates in the House like most do, it gets brought forth to the Speaker of the House, and then the Speaker decides an agenda. And so then there has to be a lot of time for introduction of the bill, deliberation, and then voted on. And then it has
introduction of the bill. What to
like? So the introduction. So the introduction is like yes. Yeah, so it's. I don't believe it's necessarily in law, but it's usually kind of good faith to release what. The legislation that's going to be voted on prior to the session. I think that there might be some stipulation of it has to be a certain amount of time beforehand. But I think it might be like, it might be vague where I haven't read the exact.
You don't have to, but it's recommended and appreciated
that
or the public or something that, hey, we're going to be
not even the public. It's the people that are going to be voting on it.
Okay. So, hey, we're going to be voting on this, by the way, just to let you know, rather than they're all in the room. What is that?
Well, that's prior to then they usually, once they're in the room, that's when they have that's when they like formally introduce it. So it's like they're supposed to send it out beforehand and say like, hey, this is what we're going to be voting on, give them time to like read it and understand what it is, and then they usually do have a brief introduction at the beginning, which is kind of like a synopsis. Like once they enter session, and they have a synopsis of like, here's basically what this does, and then they have a moment for deliberation.
And who's all in the room?
The people of Congress,
all of them.
I don't know how it is now with like some COVID. I don't know what their COVID measures right now technically are, because technically Illinois is still within emergency executive orders and stuff, but they might have options for people to be on Zoom or something like that. But essentially, yes, everybody, unless there's people that are missing for some qualified reason, everybody's in the room for it.
So when this was passed, what's his name? Dan Brady, was he down there?
I don't know the specifics about certain people,
but like just there. So I understand, people like Dan Brady would be
people,
down there.
Yeah,
they
people
would
be
state representatives. Yep. Yeah,
and they would vote yay or nay when they said we're looking to pass this thing, which is the Safety Act, which is Bill what? Or
I don't know exactly. I can look it up real quick if you want me to. It's probably H.R. something.
Oh, okay. Oh, H. 365? No, I forget what it was.
365.
No. I seriously thought that maybe I'm completely wrong. But anyway, so this gets brought up to everyone. Then everyone votes on it. Did they vote on it in the middle of the night?
Yep. Yeah, 4 in the morning. It was brought to the floor. And yeah, they did vote on it.
So all these people, all these representatives are on a Zoom call or they're in person, presumably, at 4 a.m.?
Yes.
So if I ask Dan Brady, presumably again, hey, what were you doing at 4 a.m. on that day? He's like, well, I was in this meeting. He would say yes, and then they said, here's a synopsis of what this bill is going to entail. What do you guys think, yay or nay? And they voted yay, and yeah, what'd
you find? You're actually right. It's I believe it was, from what I'm reading here, it was HB 365, House Bill 3653 is what it is.
Okay, got it. Okay, and usually it's not at 4 a.m. that this is done.
Well, what happens is they're all in, like, session. Like, so what session is like, they have a lot of times, like, this date to this date is technical session, and they can kind of be on call. Like, they usually have scheduled times in which they have different committee meetings, things like that. But you could technically be on call and say, we're going to have a special time for this, where we're all meeting at this time.
Okay, and maybe not everyone met. Maybe, okay, whatever. We'll just assume that everyone did come to the party there and they voted. What's so crazy about it being at 4 a.m. then?
Oh, well, because no media coverage. Nobody.
That's the purpose of it, is that nobody from the public will be there to protest or have their voices heard necessarily. Mm. Media won't be covering it because everybody's asleep.
Okay.
Yeah, so they just, what they're trying to do is pass it and try to pass it and fly it under the radar as much as they can so nobody knows about it.
Do they do that a lot?
Do you know what day of the week it was too? Because that would also play a role. And if it was in, like, if it was on a Thursday.
I just remember it was right before the new assembly was going to come in. Mm. It got past 20 minutes almost before the next assembly was taking over.
Because a lot of times, and I don't know if this is true for this bill, but a lot of times what government does too is they'll pass a lot of stuff on, like, on either a Friday, like, it's controversial stuff on a Friday or this could have been a Friday morning because there's usually a Friday dump of media where, like, everything else from the week is dumped on Fridays so then as to not overwhelm throughout the weekend.
Mm. So
it gets lost in the noise.
Okay. Interesting stuff. So you think that they did this at the time they did it on the day they did it so it could go under the radar as much as possible because they knew that it would reasonably cause some outrage?
Because it wouldn't be favorable. The public wouldn't be favorable of it.
Right. Huh. Why do you think they did it then if they don't think the public would be favorable of it?
Oh, because they don't care.
Well, what's their incentive? What are Democrats' incentive for passing this thing? Do they think it's good for people to be let out not on cash – or let out and not have to deal with cash bail? Do they think that's a right?
Well, and technically so. Safety is actually an acronym. And if you could – I'm going to look it up real quick.
Yeah,
safety
I have something to say too, because mine might sound – his will probably sound tame, his idea for as to why. Mine will be a little bit different. Because at the end of the day, Democrats want votes. That's kind of the way I see it. And so if they have all these people that are getting locked up and are charged with felonies and stuff and such, then they are losing voters. Mm. And so what they're trying to do is allow people out of jail to be able – if the more people they can get out of jail, the more voters that they'll have.
Uh-huh.
Because they can say, hey, look what we did for you. You might be this absolute whack job that is potentially on trial for manslaughter or any other type of homicide or these absurd crimes. But hey, they could still get votes from them.
Yeah, and then people will ask, why would they want to get votes from them? Well, there's no term limits. They can be career politicians.
Well,
no
term limits. And to them, at the end of the day, as long as they keep their power, that's what it is. It's a power grab.
Yeah.
They're consistently trying. That's why there's a lot of politicians that are arguing for illegal immigrants to be able to vote and such and things like that, because then they can keep trying to fuel a voter base based on giving people things,
mm-hmm.
even if it's a net bad for society.
Yes,
that's
they're caring about themselves. They want to stay in. Look, I like Dan Brady a lot, but I bet Dan Brady thinks he has a pretty sweet job. I bet he likes being in politics. I know him very, very well.
Yeah, I think he's a good guy, but you're right. I mean,
it's fun being in that position. If you're so well-liked and you've been there for so many years and people are always talking to you, and I don't think he's corrupt or anything, but look, he's getting invited to everything. He's getting invited to the cocktail parties. People love seeing, hey, Dan, how's it going, man? You're everywhere. Hey, you want to come to this? Maybe we'll pay you to do this, and it'll go towards your campaign. There's a lot of benefits and a lot of reasons that people, not to mention the – dopamine that you get from being in power. Mm-hmm. Like, it's lovely being in power. It's intoxicating sometimes.
Psychological studies show that it could be a genuine drug.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's why you see so many people in politics that are egomaniacs. Not to hit on you, Eduardo, a little bit there.
Trust me. That was the first lesson I learned in my campaign politics class. Day one, we learned the people who usually run for office are Machiavellian narcissists.
Machiavellian narcissist, what's that mean?
Oh, Machiavelli was a philosopher, and he had a lot of beliefs on, like, so a common kind of phrase is that Machiavelli, because he has a whole book called The Prince, which a lot of ideas to leadership are tied to, and the way that people do lead. And so one of the things that he says in that, a lot of people have probably heard a variation of it, is would you rather be loved or feared as a leader? I think it was love or feared. And he said, well, it's best to be both if you can, but it's preferable if you have to pick one to be feared, because you'd rather people be afraid of getting on your bad side if you're loved than people walk all over you.
Right. Yeah. And I always hear that Machiavellian, if something's Machiavellian, it's like particularly harsh, because back in this time, I guess he advocated for harsh punishment or something.
Yeah.
So, okay. That's interesting.
So a Machiavellian narcissist would be somebody who's like, harshly narcissist, essentially.
I see. Okay. Yeah.
Very self-absorbed. So Eduardo's very self-absorbed. No, I don't actually think Eduardo is. And I think it kind of varies too, because like Eduardo's not going to be in a national spotlight, right?
Right.
If elected, which I would say I think that'd be a good thing. But if elected, he wouldn't be in the national spotlight. So it kind of varies, because like you get to like a Dan Brady, who's a state rep. He's meeting more people. He's got more of a spotlight on him. And then you get up to people that are in Congress. And
Desi Anderson looking to be a federal.
No, she's being state senate.
She's state senate. So like that'd be.
I'm an idiot.
No, it's okay. It's okay. But she's comparable to like a Dan Brady a little bit.
Right.
So the state senate, there's less state senators than there are state reps.
If you're familiar with Jason Berkman or Sally Turner.
Hey, this is not a politics podcast. I don't claim to know everything.
No, but she's still state level. She'd be comparable enough in terms of spotlight on her to a Dan Brady. And then you get up to people that are in the national spotlight. First, you get probably to Congress, which is like your Darren LaHoods. Mm-hmm. You might know who Darren is. Or that'd be also like your Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez from New York. Those are Congress people. But those are House of Representatives people. There's 435 people in a House of Representatives. That's decided based on the population of each state. So every state has a different number. Well, some might have the same just based on population, so that's based on population. Then you have the Senate, where there is 100. There's two per state, no matter what. And so that's so that you can have a representation based on population and representation that's equal across the board in the Senate. Mm-hmm. And so there's more spotlight a little bit on the Senate. A lot to the average person, it might not seem as such, because like it's Congress as a whole. So it's just, oh, you're just a congressperson. But there's usually more spotlight on the Senate than Congress, because Senate, there's only two per state.
Right.
As Congress, how many congressional districts do we have in Illinois? What, like 20?
Yeah.
17, 18, somewhere around there. I don't know how much it was since we've changed it. But so then you get up to the president and then people that are within the executive branch. And then that has even more of a spotlight. So the ego just continues to inflate in politics. And that's why people are worried about like J.B. Pritzker running for president or things like that. Because it's like, okay, you already have such a spotlight on you. Are you really using these positions? And it happens with Republicans too. The question of, are you going to run for president? Are we going to see you here? It really, the real question at hand there that's underlying and between the lines is that, are you representing us to represent us, or are you using this as a stepping stone to fuel your ego?
Right, right. Yeah, and you have to have that question when the person you're talking about is a multi-billionaire. It's like, yeah, you doing this for the good of the people? I don't know. All interesting stuff. Guys, we've been talking for about an hour and a half now. We might as well wrap this thing up. We'll have you on again. We'll do this all again. But Eddie, what do you want to tell people? How can they vote for you? When can they vote for you?
Yep, so early voting's been open now. There are locations in the Bone Student Center, Watterson Towers, open 10 to 4 on weekends. Tuesday's the election. Go vote. You can find me on Facebook, Eduardo Monk Jr. from McLean County Board District 6. You can also find me on Instagram as well. So keep up with the campaign there, and then, yeah, we're hitting the home stretch of this thing now.
Right on. Sounds good, guys. That was fun. I got a 5-star education there as well. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you, Paul.
All right. That's a wrap.